The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We are reading this week from the June 5th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine, and once again, we are in new territory this week, folks. My print copy of the magazine did not come in, and so I'm going to work from the online version of the magazine. I downloaded the app on my phone, and we'll see how it goes, so bear with me. The cover drawing this week shows a cemetery. There are a lot of headstones. There are three freshly dug graves in the front right-hand corner of it. In the middle of it, you see President Trump. He's in his golfing clothes, and it looks like he's just finished a golf swing. The headline is "Playing Through." As U.S. corona deaths hit 100,000, Trump golfs and rage tweets. And as usual, we'll start with the main stories and how they were covered. U.S. coronavirus deaths hit 100,000. What happened? America's pandemic death toll climbed past 100,000 this week as states continued lifting restrictions amid concerns that an accelerated return to public life may launch a new wave of coronavirus infections. The grim milestone came as Memorial Day weekend ushered in the most unusual summer season in memory. With concerts and baseball games canceled, summer camps shuttered, and even simple pleasures like a trip to an ice cream stand complicated by fears of contagion and conflicts over masks and distancing. The nation's overall infection numbers have slowed, with steep drops in deaths and hospitalizations in hard-hit New York and New Jersey, as well as Illinois and Michigan, following weeks of strict stay-at-home orders. But confirmed cases were trending upward in 20 states, with hot spots in Alabama, Missouri, and North Carolina, and the virus reaching rural communities with vulnerable populations and few hospital beds. "I'm concerned that there are people who think that this is the all clear," said former Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Scott Gottlieb. In locales across the country, maskless revelers packed together in boisterous Memorial Day celebrations, even as flags flew at half-mast to commemorate the 100,000 dead. Crowds thronged the boardwalk in Ocean City, Maryland, tap danced in the streets of Daytona Beach. Bathing suit partiers stood shoulder to shoulder in Missouri's Lake of the Ozarks, while thousands filled the stands at the Ace Speedway in Alamance County, North Carolina, in defiance of a state order limiting gatherings to 25. "We're tired of being stuck in the house," spectator Becky Woolsey said. "I'm not afraid of this virus one bit." Meanwhile, President Trump spent the weekend golfing at his club in Virginia and launching a barrage of tweets at perceived enemies. He retweeted a message calling Hillary Clinton a skank and another depicting House Speaker Nancy Pelosi with her mouth duct-taped shut. He also repeatedly called for a murder investigation of MSNBC host Joe Scarborough, a frequent critic in the 2001 death of a former congressional aide, a groundless claim that appalled many fellow Republicans. See Best U.S. Columns. Trump made no mention of the Americans who died of COVID-19. What the editorial said: The number 100,000 is almost too enormous to grasp, said the Houston Chronicle. It's 33 times greater than the death toll from 9/11, and more deaths than America suffered in the Vietnam, Korean, and Iraq wars combined. But these people were not numbers. They were cooks, retired teachers, law enforcement officers, church leaders, nurses, spouses, and grandparents, many of whom died alone, tethered to ventilators, and forced to say final farewells by phones and iPads. The U.S. is suffering the blue state lockdown blues, said the Wall Street Journal. Our national recovery is being hampered by slow-moving Democratic states that represent about a third of the U.S. economy. Nearly 10 weeks of strict lockdowns in California, New York, New Jersey, and Illinois have led to severe job losses. 41% of construction jobs have been lost in New York, for example, compared with 4% in Florida. The result will be business foreclosures, evictions, and bankruptcies felt well beyond those states' borders. What the columnist said, as the United States death toll raced towards 100,000, Donald Trump went golfing, said Charles Blow in the New York Times. It's a perfect symbol for the president's catastrophic handling of a pandemic that never had to reach such a staggering figure. A new Columbia University study found that if the U.S. had started social distancing 2 weeks earlier, it could have prevented 84% of deaths and 82% of cases. Instead, Trump defied truth and science and insisted the virus would simply just go away. In America, this is Donald Trump's plague. The COVID-19 lockdown has served its purpose, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. The goal wasn't to shut the virus down entirely, which is impossible. It was to buy time to learn how to minimize harm and prevent hospitals from being overwhelmed. We have accomplished those goals. At a cost of almost 40 million lost jobs, profound mental suffering, and our children's lost education. It's time to send our citizens back to work and our children back to school. Most people say otherwise, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. As numbers in many areas continue to rise, public opinion is astonishingly united behind social distancing measures. Public health experts are warning of a resurgence, and there's not much evidence that simply dropping restrictions will save the economy. Indeed, it may backfire. So why are we inviting people to return to gyms, hair salons, public pools, and restaurants? A small slice of the population, led by the President of the United States, has managed to drive this momentous and risky move. What next? A second wave of infections is projected to hit the South and Midwest, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. New modeling from Imperial College London indicates that the virus may still be invisibly spreading at epidemic rates in 24 states. Many controlled by Republicans. Their governors align themselves with Trump in the culture wars and are needlessly promoting risky conduct. Texas reported its highest single-day number of new cases and deaths 2 weeks after it reopened. Yet the state continues to relax restrictions on everything from tanning salons to movie theaters. Up to now, people in Trump country have been hit harder by job losses than by coronavirus, said Mike Dorning and Gregory Court in Bloomberg.com. In states Trump won in 2016, 23 people have lost a job for every one person infected, compared with 13 job losses for every one person infected in states that went to Hillary Clinton. But the number of cases in the Trump states is rising 46% faster than in blue states. If rural areas get hit hard, the political backlash could be fierce. Our controversy of the week, churches, should they be allowed to reopen? It's about time, said John Davidson in TheFederalist.com. This week, as stores and other businesses began to reopen across the nation, groups of religious leaders filed lawsuits for the right to do the same. With churches filled to a third of capacity and following social distancing guidelines, some are holding services in defiance of Democratic governors who are still showing a dangerous ignorance or perhaps indifference about the place of religious freedom and freedom of conscience in our constitutional system. In Minnesota, Governor Tim Walz tipped his liberal hand by keeping churches closed even as shopping malls, bars, and hair salons reopened, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, until public pressure forced him to retreat. But the governors of California, Michigan, and Illinois are sticking to their unconstitutional guns, earning a warning last week from President Trump. The governors need to do the right thing and allow these very important essential places of faith to open right now, Trump said. And if they don't do it, I will override the governors. Legally, Trump may not have that power, but he's right. The First Amendment guarantees the right to the free exercise of religion. What is the legal justification for allowing shopping malls to reopen while churches must keep their doors closed? We'll give it a shot, said the Chicago Tribune in an editorial. Governors have sweeping powers to protect the public health, and churches have proved uniquely efficient vectors for transmitting the coronavirus. One singer at a March choir practice in Washington infected 52 of 61 members, two of whom died. A similar outbreak at a church in Arkansas infected 35 attendees, who in turn infected 21 in the community. Three people died. A service in Frankfurt, Germany infected 107, even with social distancing. Gathering crowds in confined spaces is a great way to spread COVID-19, said Judy Stone in Forbes.com. And if you add singing to the mix, an activity that expels virus-filled droplets from the mouth with greater velocity and range than regular speech or breathing, the deadly effect is magnified. If we reopen America's churches today, all those vocal expressions of faith will fuel more outbreaks and death. Federal guidance would be useful here, said Lena Sun and Josh Dalzy in the Washington Post. But while the Centers for Disease Control released a detailed roadmap for reopening schools, restaurants, and mass transit, equivalent CDC guidelines for churches were blocked by a White House reluctant to alienate the faithful. Trump's stance is motivated by pure politics, not a genuine concern for religious liberty, said Gabby Orr in Politico.com. His aides are panicked that a poll showed double-digit drops in his favorability with white Christians in only a month due to the president's botched handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Some governors have certainly gone too far in their church lockdown, said Rod Dreher in TheAmericanConservative.com. But the coronavirus doesn't care about our politics. Any priest, pastor, or rabbi who puts loyalty to Trump above the safety of worshipers is indulging in recklessness. For now, the faithful can worship in virtual services, said the Reverend Edward Beck in CNN.com. To put ourselves and our parishioners in danger by gathering them in enclosed physical spaces just to strike a blow for some politicized notion of religious liberty would endanger something more precious, what we Catholics like to call the right to life. And here's our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for revelations. After Will Carroll, drummer for the thrash metal band Death Angel, survived COVID-19 and reported that he visited hell while in a 12-day medically induced coma. I don't think Satan's quite as cool as I used to, Carroll said. It was a good week for conformity after Elon Musk and Grimes bowed to California's prohibition on using numbers in names, changing the name of their newborn son from XAEA12 to XAEAXII. Roman numerals, shrugged Grimes on Twitter. Looks better, TBH, to be honest. And it was a good week for concert goers who may soon be able to enjoy live music again in the high-tech confines of antiviral protective suit called Microshell. Its LA-based designers say the fun-to-wear Microshell has an onboard air filtration system, as well as lights, speakers, and snap-on canister for vaping and drinking. But it was a bad week for hyperbole after feminist author Katha Pollitt, writing about sexual assault allegations against Joe Biden, said that she would vote for Biden over Donald Trump even if he boiled babies and ate them. It was a bad week for Dear Leader's mystique after North Korea's official state newspaper debunked the myth that Kim Jong-un is a master of Chokjibibop, an ancient method of teleportation. In realistic terms, said Rodong Sinmun in an editorial, a person cannot suddenly disappear and reappear by folding space. And finally, it was a bad week for cultural appropriation after a Wyoming-based Etsy vendor designed a face mask with Yiddish characters that she thought said NYC strong. But the mask actually read NYC crotch. Nevertheless, the designer said, I was stunned by the demand. Here are a couple of pieces from the U.S. at a glance. This first one, I'm sure, will be the lead story or part of the lead story next week. I Can't Breathe from Minneapolis. Four police officers involved in the arrest of a black man who died in custody were fired this week after a bystander's video showed a white officer, Derek Chauvin, pressing his knee into the man's neck as he pleaded, I can't breathe. The FBI is investigating the death of George Floyd, 46, a restaurant bouncer detained under suspicion of trying to use a counterfeit $20 bill at a convenience store. The initial police statement said that he resisted officers, but video shows bystanders begging an officer to stop kneeling on Floyd's neck while he is handcuffed and lying face down on the street. He's talking, so he's breathing, another officer said. Police kept applying pressure to Floyd's neck, even as his nose started bleeding and he stopped moving. They treated him worse than they treat animals, Floyd's brother, Philanese, said. Convention clash, Charlotte, North Carolina. President Trump threatened this week to pull the Republican National Convention from Charlotte if Democratic Governor Roy Cooper wouldn't immediately commit to letting conservatives pack an arena from August 24th to 27th. GOP leaders say they are going full steam ahead with plans for a convention, even as North Carolina sees a surge in coronavirus cases. It's okay for political conventions to be political, Cooper said, but pandemic responses cannot be. And he would not make promises about future rules. After Trump complained on Twitter that North Carolina is still in shutdown mood, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said he would love to get the convention, and the mayor of Jacksonville, Florida, a leading contender among possible venues, also said he would back a move. Democrats are mulling limited attendance or an entirely remote convention if Milwaukee is unsafe in August. Racist rant, New York City. A white woman ignited an onslaught of criticism this week after she called 911 over a dog leashing dispute and screamed that an African American man was threatening me. A video viewed more than 40 million times shows Amy Cooper, 41, unleashing her dog in a semi-wild section of Central Park, then erupting when a bird watcher told her she was violating park rules. She marched toward 57-year-old Christian Cooper, no relation, a Harvard-educated biomedical editor and a board member of New York's Audubon Society, and told him to stop recording her, saying she would call the police. I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life. While pleading for cops to come, Cooper fought to restrain her dog by the collar. Within 24 hours, she was fired by the financial firm Franklin Templeton and gave up her adopted Cocker Spaniel. She apologized, saying, "Her entire life is being destroyed." This is the world at a glance. COVID deaths soar. Mexico City. Mexico City may be experiencing a far worse coronavirus outbreak than has been officially recorded. A new study of death certificates shows that the capital registered 8,000 more deaths from January 1st to May 20th than the average for the same period over the past 4 years. City authorities had put the COVID-19 death toll at fewer than 2,000 for that period, while the official toll for the whole country is only about 7,400. The study's authors say it's likely that not all of the excess deaths are directly attributable to the virus. Some could be deaths of people who avoided hospitals for fear of catching the virus and died after waiting too long for care. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador insists that Mexico has tamed the coronavirus and that the country will reopen to visitors in June or July, starting with popular tourist destinations such as Puerto Vallarta and Cancun. Iran to the rescue. Caracas. In defiance of U.S. sanctions, two Iranian oil tankers arrived in Venezuela this week bearing desperately needed gasoline. Although Venezuela sits on the world's biggest oil reserves, corruption and economic decay have wrecked its energy sector. It is suffering shortages of gas and diesel for cars and propane for cooking. Iran is unable to sell its oil on international markets because of U.S. sanctions against it. "We are two rebel revolutionary peoples that are never going to kneel before North American imperialism," said Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. State Department accused the Maduro government of being a criminal organization that used illegally mined gold to buy Iranian oil. Keep your distance, Milan. Italians endured one of the strictest lockdowns in Europe during the peak of their coronavirus outbreak, and now that they are allowed to return to bars and beaches, they aren't holding back. So this week, Italian mayors began imposing new restrictions on gatherings after a weekend of intense partying saw people crowding into bars and piazzas and removing their masks. "This weekend has not been serene," said Milan Mayor Giuseppe Sala, who has now banned the sale of takeout alcoholic drinks after 7 p.m. The mayor of the southeastern town of Pulsano, meanwhile, has shut down beach access until June to put a cap on crowds. "The appeal to common sense," said Francesco Lupoli, "hasn't worked." Can't visit U.S. Brasilia. In an attempt to contain the spread of the coronavirus, President Trump this week issued an executive order barring entry of foreigners traveling from Brazil, which now has the second highest number of infections in the world after the U.S. As with the Trump administration's other travel bans, the new rule does not apply to U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents. Brazil has registered some 380,000 COVID-19 cases and at least 23,600 deaths. But President Jair Bolsonaro continues to downplay the severity of the outbreak. Opposition politicians use the new travel ban to mock Bolsonaro, who is a huge fan of Trump. "Brazil, a health risk to the world thanks to Jair Bolsonaro," tweeted Vladimir Assuncao, a lawmaker with the left-wing Workers' Party. "Even the U.S., whose president boot he licks, has banned the entry of Brazilians." Our briefing page article is "The Truth About Masks." Health officials now recommend that people cover their faces in public places. Are masks effective? How do masks fight COVID-19? The mouth and nose are usually where the coronavirus first sets up camp and also serve as the portals for spreading the virus to new hosts. The saliva of infected people teems with virus particles, which are emitted in droplets when they cough or sneeze. Smaller drops, called aerosols, are launched when a person speaks or even just breathes. Larger droplets are thought to be the primary means of transmission and can be propelled 6 or more feet before gravity pulls them down to the ground. Aerosol droplets can hang in the air, still visible and potentially capable of causing infections for hours, especially in enclosed spaces with poor ventilation. By serving as a barrier, masks block the droplets expelled by an infected person and slow the velocity of particles that sneak through. To a lesser extent, they protect the wearer from receiving particles in their own mouth and nose. How effective are masks? Though different studies reach varying statistical conclusions, the overwhelming consensus is that they can help stem transmission. Jeremy Howard, an Australian data scientist who created the website maskforall.co, has identified 34 papers showing their effectiveness, and none that show otherwise. Researchers from the National Institutes of Health performed a video experiment that offered a stark visual rendering of how masks work. They used laser light to illuminate the shower of droplets emitted when someone speaks, or demonstrated how nearly all of them were blocked by a mask. A team of scientists and academics from Europe and California recently built a computer simulation demonstrating that if 80% of the population wore masks, infection rates would plunge by more than 90%. That finding lines up with remarkably low infection rates in Asian countries where mask wearing is near universal, including Hong Kong and Taiwan, each of which has fewer than 10 deaths despite high population density. The countries that flatten the curve used masks in public, says Dutch disease expert Chris Kenyon. Do masks protect the wearer? Not perfectly, but yes. One meta study funded by the World Health Organization that analyzed 64 scientific papers found that masks dropped wearers' risk of infection by between 50 and 80%. And while N95 masks, which block 95% of particles 0.3 microns or larger, fare the best, surgical and cloth masks can also be highly successful. One study found that for inward protection, N95 masks were 99% effective, surgical masks 75%, and a cloth tea towel, 67%. Even if some virus gets through, scientists theorize, reducing the amount can make a big difference. If the initial exposure is large, the virus may overwhelm the immune system and cause serious illness. If it's relatively small, a mask wearer may get a mild case or none at all. Why are masks controversial? Early in the pandemic, mixed signals from health officials created confusion. While the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention now recommends that people wear masks, it initially told them not to. At the time, the CDC was worried that the public would hoard medical-grade masks needed by frontline workers. Health officials also worried that untrained mask wearers would contaminate their masks or their hands by mishandling them, thus increasing their risk, and that masks might give wearers a false sense of security. While strong consensus is now in favor of masks, experts warn that they're not magical shields, just part of an arsenal that includes hand washing and social distancing. Putting a face mask on does not mean that you stop the other practices, said Mei Chu, an epidemiologist at the Colorado School of Public Health. What kind of mask should I wear? N95 masks should be kept for medical professionals. But if you have a stray one around the house, it offers the highest protection as long as it's properly worn, with no gaps between your face and the mask. Commercially available surgical masks can be highly effective, studies have found. Cloth masks also provide protection, but to varying degrees. A Wake Forest University study found great variation depending on the material used, with the best ones reaching 79% filtration. Look for materials with a dense weave, such as quilter's cotton, flannel, or pillowcases with high thread count, and use a double layer. Including a filter, such as a piece cut from a coffee filter or vacuum cleaner bag, increases the effectiveness but may inhibit breathing. Masks should fit snugly against the face and reach below the chin and up to the bridge of the nose. Wash them after each use, and when removing them, handle them by the straps, never the protective material, which could be contaminated, and wash your hands directly before and after. Wearing a mask takes some getting used to for sure, said Scott Segal, chairman of the anesthesiology at Wake Forest Baptist Health. If it's a little stuffy, you are probably wearing it exactly right. Turning masks into partisan symbols. If masks are so effective, why are some Americans so resistant to wearing them? Given that we have no history of mask wearing, it's not surprising they seem alien. But the major reason is the degree to which the pandemic has been politicized. To supporters of President Trump, who has insisted on going maskless, reportedly because he thinks it would make him look weak to wear one, masks indicate a groundless fear of a virus whose danger they believe are exaggerated in order to limit their freedom. When masks become a tribal marker, being asked to wear one is like asking a Red Sox fan to put on a Yankees jersey, psychologist Seth Gillihan wrote in Psychology Today. Psychologists point to other conscious and unconscious factors. Some people may think that mask wearing would reveal feelings of vulnerability, running counter to an evolutionary trait that predisposes us to disguise fear. Wearing a mask also conveys an acknowledgement that our old lives are gone, at least for now. Put on a mask, said clinical psychologist David Abrams, and you've suddenly admitted that this is the new normal. We'll move into a few of the best columns of the week, starting with Trump's cowardly tweets. Punching down is the mark of a bully, said S.E. Crump, and it's President Trump's specialty. On Memorial Day weekend, when we marked a grim pandemic milestone of 100,000 Americans dead, Trump sank to a new low, issuing a flurry of nutty tweets accusing MSNBC host Joe Scarborough of murdering an aide in his congressional office nearly 20 years ago. The aide, Lori Klausutis, 28, had a heart condition that caused her to faint, hit her head on an office desk, and die of her injuries. Scarborough was in Washington, D.C. that day, casting multiple votes. Yet Trump has dragged the tragic death back into the spotlight to baselessly smear Scarborough with no regard to the pain it is causing Klausutis' family. Her widower, Timothy, wrote a heart-wrenching letter to Twitter head Jack Dorsey, begging him to remove the disgusting tweets, saying Trump was stealing the memory of my dead wife to engage in a petty feud. To the horror of fellow Republicans, Trump persists. Panicked by the pandemic, Trump has become more and more erratic, unbalanced, unhinged, and self-sabotaging. Our president has proved himself to be a small, weak, insecure coward with no impulse control, compassion, or common decency. What Biden's, quote, ain't black gaffe reveals. Joe Biden has revealed an ugly truth, said Rod Dreher. The presumptive Democratic presidential nominee snapped at a black radio talk show host last week. If you have a problem with figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, then you ain't black. Biden later apologized for the offensive comment, and nobody thinks his gaffe will cause black voters to flip to Trump. But several black writers defended the old white guy, saying in essence that he was inelegantly correct. If you don't agree with the left, then you're not only wrong, you're a race traitor. That accusation is how black liberals police opinion among black folks and make pariahs of black conservatives. But why must all black people have the same political opinions? There are no doubt plenty of white people who vote out of a sense of this candidate is good for whites, but appeals to white racial solidarity are branded racist. Liberals don't seem to recognize the hypocrisy of condoning and even endorsing the idea that all authentic blacks must vote only for Democrats. If we accept the proposition that voting is purely a matter of racial identity, we are going to be a much worse country. Who do you let into your bubble? As we begin to emerge from lockdown, said Joyce Wadler, we will all have to decide who it is safe to socialize with. Early research suggests that COVID-19 carriers do not exhibit symptoms for 3 to 14 days after infection, and 25% or more may never get symptoms, yet will still be able to transmit the virus to others. So without visible illness to guide us, it becomes very tricky to select a group of friends, couples, and family members we can safely see, a sacred bubble of people who vow to practice the highest vigilance and not infect you. That may mean submitting the people we love to off-putting interrogations. Do you always wear a mask and socially distance when going to stores? Have you spent time with, say, an adult child whose coworker's husband came down with COVID-19? How many degrees of coronavirus separation are necessary? If I feel tempted to buy a hot dog from a stand manned by careless-looking teenagers, must I confess to my bubble mates? The stakes for all concerned are high. Remember, if you or any of your circle of friends makes one unwise decision, the plus one at dinner could be Mr. COVID. The Last Word article, titled this week, A Tragic Homecoming. The Trump administration's chaotic ban on travel from Europe didn't slow down the coronavirus, said Greg Miller, Josh Dawsey, and Aaron Davis in the Washington Post. In fact, it made it spread even faster. To keep new cases from entering our shores, President Trump said in the Oval Office address on March 11th, we will be suspending all travel from Europe to the United States for the next 30 days. Across the Atlantic, Jack Siebert, an American college student spending a semester in Spain, was battling raging headaches, shortness of breath, and fevers that touched 104 degrees. Concerned about his condition for travel, but alarmed by the president's announcement, his parents scrambled to book a flight home for their son, an impulse shared by thousands of Americans who rushed to get flights out of Europe. Siebert arrived at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago 3 days later as the new U.S. restrictions, including mandatory medical screenings, went into effect. He encountered crowds of people packed in tight corridors, stood in lines in which he snaked past other travelers for nearly 5 hours, and tried to direct any cough or sneeze into his sleeve. When he finally reached the coronavirus checkpoint near baggage pickup, Siebert reported his prior symptoms and described his exposure in Spain. The screeners waved him through with a cursory temperature check. He was given instructions to self-isolate that struck him as absurd given the conditions he had just encountered. I can guarantee you that people were infected in that transatlantic gauntlet, said Siebert, who tested positive for the virus 2 days later. It was people passing through a pinhole. The sequence was repeated at airports across the country that weekend, harrowing scenes of interminable lines and unmasked faces crammed in confined spaces spread across social media. The images showed how a policy intended to block the pathogen's entry into the United States instead delivered one final viral infusion. Epidemiologists say the U.S. outbreak was driven overwhelmingly by viral strains from Europe rather than China. More than 1.8 million travelers entered the United States from Europe in February alone as that continent became the center of the pandemic. The crush of travelers triggered by Trump's announcement only added to that viral load. On March 13th, the day the European travel restrictions were implemented, there were only 3,714 confirmed COVID-19 cases in the United States, and just 176 deaths had been recorded. For much of the preceding month, Trump had predicted the virus would quickly recede and downplayed its severity. "It will go away," he declared on March 10th, one day before his address from the Oval Office. "Just stay calm. It will go away." Behind the scenes, however, senior officials had been agitating for weeks to consider expanding travel restrictions beyond China. After the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus a global pandemic on March 11th, members of the administration's coronavirus task force and other White House officials gathered in a tense meeting in the Cabinet Room. A small contingent then gathered around Trump in the Oval Office. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin was against a ban on travel from Europe, officials said, vociferously arguing that its potentially damaging effect on the economy. But others, including Robert O'Brien, the National Security Advisor, and Alex Azar, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, argued the United States could no longer justify the risk of allowing travel from Europe to continue unimpeded. Trump sided with the majority, but the magnitude of the undertaking constricting one of the busiest air travel corridors on the planet seemed to escape him, and the logistical requirements of implementing this plan on a 48-hour timetable were not even meaningfully discussed, officials said. Instead, Trump and his inner circle seemed focused on staging the announcement for maximum political impact. Jared Kushner, the president's advisor and son-in-law, urged Trump to deliver a formal speech that evening. Kushner then joined senior policy advisor Stephen Miller in the latter's office to work on a draft. The duo were still making edits until shortly before Trump was scheduled to go live on television at 9 p.m. "The president was in a bad mood," one official said. As he settled into his chair, Trump cursed about a stain on his shirt. He wasn't convinced the speech was a good idea. It was only the second Oval Office address of his presidency, reflecting the gravity of the moment. But the result was a stumbling performance in which Trump struggled to follow the text on the teleprompter and committed a series of gaffes. "Never has a less prepared set of remarks been delivered from that room," said a former administration official. "The new restrictions included exemptions for Americans who have undergone appropriate screenings," he said. But few caught that important caveat after his opening declaration that the United States was suspending all travel from Europe. As networks cut away, Trump was caught muttering a drawn-out, "Okay," as he slumped in his seat. Within days, he was blaming Kushner, telling aides that he shouldn't have listened to his son-in-law. At Dulles International Airport outside Washington, the cabin door on United Flight 989, headed for Frankfurt, Germany, had just been secured when Trump's speech began airing on television networks. As he spoke, passengers began rising from their seats in panic, brandishing bulletins about the speech on their cell phones. Some pushed for the exits. "He said they're closing the borders," one passenger said. "I want off this plane." The pilot and cabin began making frantic calls to supervisors for guidance. Bobby Moss, a veteran flight attendant, dialed a hotline for United employees, then the company's staffing office at Dulles, but no one had answers. She then entered the cockpit to speak to the captain, who would be first in line for any major air travel advisories. The captain contacted United's operations desk, the nerve center of the airline, but officials there were similarly scrambling for details. The only warning conveyed to the airline was a call that United's then chief executive, Oscar Munoz, got from an administration official literally minutes before Trump began speaking, a company spokesman said. The official provided no details about what Trump would be saying, except that it pertained to air travel. By the time the Boeing 777 departed for Frankfurt 2 hours later, nearly every U.S. citizen had gotten off the plane. For many, the decision was driven by the erroneous impression created by the president that they risked being stranded in Europe. Among those who deplaned was Moss, who is also a union representative with the Association of Flight Attendants. Worried that she had not packed enough prescription medicine to last a month trapped in Europe, she said she asked to get off an aircraft for the first time in her 21-year career. There was fear and chaos, she said. Save for the tense days that followed September 11, 2001 attack, she said, I have never seen anything like it. More chaos was in store. Even when given accurate details on the policy, many travelers rushed home to the U.S., fearing the administration might abruptly switch course and end the exemption. Airlines websites and phone lines were inundated in the hours after Trump's Oval Office address. American Airlines fielded about 700,000 calls on March 12th, the spokesman said, more than five times the number on a typical day. Travel across the Atlantic surged. Gate attendants began making panic calls after encountering symptomatic passengers. We had customer agents calling the security desk by the hundreds telling us about individuals that have the symptoms, the official said. Our answer was to follow policy, which meant they were not to be kept off aircraft unless they were demonstrably unfit to fly or had recently traveled to China. Travelers who arrived in the U.S. before the restrictions kicked in faced crowded planes and extended waits, even without the additional layer of medical screenings. But the next wave of travelers, which began arriving around March 14th, confronted scenes out of a public health nightmare. The number of arriving passengers had, in fact, plummeted by the first day under the new restrictions. Just 19,418 passengers arrived from designated countries in Europe, less than half as many as on the previous day. But even the dramatically reduced passenger volume overwhelmed airport screeners. Alarming photos and expressions of outrage lit up social media throughout March 14th. To find yourself waiting 4 hours in a crowded customs hall is not social distancing, a passenger arriving in San Francisco posted. Fix that or fail. JFK Airport in New York had turned into a coronavirus breeding ground, one traveler tweeted, where teeming crowds were being subjected to useless enhanced COVID screening measures. The most disturbing scenes emerged from Chicago's O'Hare. By late evening, conditions had become so unsafe that Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker began delivering broadsides about the crush of people on Twitter. Since this is the only communication medium you pay attention to, he tweeted, taking an explicit aim at the president, you need to do something now. Yet even as the crowds massed at the airport, experts were already warning that it was too late. Can anyone justify the European travel restriction scientifically? Tom Bossert, a former Homeland Security advisor at the National Security Council, asked a group of public health experts in an email sent late on the evening of March 11th. The resounding answer he got was no. By mid-February, weeks before the Trump administration acted, European strains were already established in New York, where they multiplied in the city's crowded streets and subways before fanning out to the rest of the country. The virus was already too widespread in the United States for travel curbs alone to make any difference. Horse out of the barn, said Stuart Ray, a professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins University and expert on infectious disease. The plan also depended on authorities' ability to trace individuals exposed by incoming travelers. This entails obtaining passenger manifests from airlines and contacting anyone who sat within several rows of someone who tests positive. But that protocol was rendered pointless by the chaos in airports. Siebert, the student who studied abroad, appears to have encountered all of these issues upon his return from Madrid. After Siebert filled out the CDC questionnaire and reported his previous symptoms, the screener took his temperature and stepped away briefly. "You're good, just go self-isolate," the screener said when he came back, according to Siebert. Exhausted, the New York University drama student retrieved his bags and was greeted by family members who took him home. Siebert, 21, said he was never contacted about any of the information he reported to officials at the airport. The next day, Siebert went to be tested at Northwestern Memorial Hospital in Chicago. The results came back confirming his infection. His mother also came down with the illness, though her symptoms appeared before Siebert's return. "The two isolated themselves for weeks in the household," he said, "and no other family members became sick." Siebert was among 110,000 passengers screened during the first 4 days of the European travel restrictions. According to the CDC, only 140 cases of infection were either identified by airport evaluations or reported to the center by local health authorities. If other travelers were exposed by Siebert's infection, it is unlikely any of them were ever told. A CDC spokesman said the center has conducted contact tracing investigations on the 9 Europe to United States flights since the restrictions began. Iberia Flight 6275, the one Siebert took to get home, was not among them. A version of this article was originally published in the Washington Post. On the Talking Points page, we have an article titled, "Vice President, Who is Biden's Best Choice?" "Joe Biden's search for a running mate is turning into an open audition," said Gabrielle DeBenedetti in NYMag.com. "In past years, those under consideration kept mum, but the chance to run alongside Biden, who at 77 might cede the stage to his vice president after one term in office, has Democrats publicly jockeying for the job. Biden has promised to pick a woman, and he says he wants one with national political experience with whom he feels, quote, simpatico. Many insiders are convinced he will choose one of the top three female senators who ran for president this year: California's Kamala Harris, Massachusetts' Elizabeth Warren, or Minnesota's Amy Klobuchar. Biden's highly consequential choice," said Rachel Bitcoffer in the New York Times, "boils down to whether he wants a balancer, such as the liberal Warren, or a complementer, such as the moderate Klobuchar. The left wing of the party is desperate for Biden to pick one of their own," said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times, "but he should resist that pressure. Most Democrats view President Trump as a world historic threat, so Biden doesn't need a lefty to get out the vote. Biden needs to woo moderates who don't necessarily despise Trump, but crave a return to normalcy. Far left VP options, such as Warren and Stacey Abrams, the former Georgia gubernatorial candidate, risk scaring those voters away. Biden won the nomination by campaigning as an experienced pragmatist, and he should pick a centrist, wonky, pleasant running mate, such as Klobuchar or Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer." "Klobuchar appeared to be pulling ahead last week," said Eric Lutz in VanityFair.com, "until a major gaffe by Biden complicated matters. When a black interviewer urged Biden to tap a woman of color, he quipped, 'If you have a problem with figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, then you ain't black.' That cringer could alienate people of color, and Biden's November chances depend on massive minority turnout. That's why Harris is the safest choice," said Bill Scheer in RealClearPolitics.com. The 55-year-old daughter of Jamaican and Indian immigrants, who was close to Biden's late son, Beau, and shares the nominee's pragmatic streak. Progressives dislike Klobuchar, while big money donors shudder over Warren. Harris meets the number one criteria for vice presidents: do no harm. Among the short notes, we have nearly half the Twitter messages agitating to reopen America are likely coming from bots, according to analysis by Carnegie Mellon University. The tweeting appears to be aimed at sowing division, said the lead researcher, and definitely matches the Russian and Chinese playbooks. On the poll watch, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has opened up a 48% to 40% lead over President Trump. Voters 65 and up prefer Biden over Trump by 17%. In 2016, Trump won seniors by 7%. Biden also leads among women by 20% and blacks by 64%. Trump leads among men by 7% and rural whites by 30%. And we'll finish up with a quote from newscaster David Brinkley, who says very succinctly, everyone is entitled to my opinion. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program was generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138.